nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so we've been talking about exact two-level minimization in the context of two-level synthesis. So we will continue that discussion, and today we'll conclude our discussion on exact two-level minimization and move on to talking about heuristic techniques for the same problem. So to recap what we were talking about in the last lecture, towards the end of last lecture, we were talking about the challenges involved in scaling the Quine-McCluskey algorithm to large circuits or large functions. We noted that the covering problem itself is NP-complete, so the worst case is going to be exponential in the size of the covering table, and the covering table itself is 3 power n, order of 3 power n by n, potentially in terms of the columns, which is the number of primes of a function with n inputs, and the number of onset midterms, or the number of rows, can be order of 2 power n, where again n is the number of inputs to the function. So it turns out that in practice, there exists a lot of functions, or many functions, with the number of primes not that large. So although in the worst case, you do have an exponent in terms of the number of columns, it is not frequently encountered in practice. Similarly, the inherent NP completeness of the covering problem also will, there is no way to get around it in the worst case. However, efficient techniques like branch and bound can be used to overcome the complexity for most cases in practice. But what is most likely to hit you, the place where the complexity of the problem is most likely to hit in the Quine-McCluskey that we've discussed so far, is in the number of rows, that is the number of onset midterms. So now, what remains as the primary challenge, the first challenge to scaling Quine-McCluskey is going to be in representing the covering table itself and solving the covering problem on this covering table, can we reduce the number of rows without starting off with a large number of rows? Towards that end, we started talking about unit functions. In this lecture, we'll see how that concept is actually useful to reduce the size of the covering table. But the quick recap is that the logic function is positive unit in one of its input variables, x, if increasing the input variable cannot decrease the function. So we said that this is like the concept of monotonically increasing functions when you talk about, you know, functions in the real and integer world. So increasing x cannot decrease f when f is positive unit in x. Similarly, f is negative unit in x, if increasing x cannot increase f or cannot make f go from 0 to 1. A function is unit if it's unit in all its variables, either positive or negative, but it's unit in all its variables, and a function that is not unit is said to be binate. And we gave a couple of examples. If you look at the function on top, the function here, you can see that this function with respect to variable a is positive unit because the function either stays constant or goes from 0 to 1 as you change a from 0 to 1. Similarly, you can see that this function is positive unit in both b as well as c. On the other hand, if you look at function g with respect to, let's say, variable x, you see that you have one instance of vertex here where as you change x from 0 to 1, the function goes from 0 to 1. In other words, you go from the offset to the onset. But you have another instance where as you change x from 0 to 1, the function also goes from 1 to 0. So neither of these unitness properties hold. Therefore, the function g is binate in the variable x. Okay, so with that quick recap, let's move on. The concept of unit functions can also be extended into covers. Remember, covers are nothing but representations of functions. So a function is, you know, uniquely specified, let's say, by its truth table or its hypercube representation. A cover, there can be several possible covers to represent the same function. It's not a unique representation. However, it is also a representation of the function. A cover is said to be positive unit in a variable if and only if the complement of the variable doesn't appear in any of the cubes of the cover, right? So each of the cubes is a conjunction of literals. If the negative phase or the complement of the literal xi of the variable xi, if xi prime never appears in any of the cubes, that cover is said to be positive unit in xi. Similarly, it's negative unit if the uncomplemented form never occurs anywhere in the cubes of the cover. Okay. And a cover is unit if it's unit in each and every one of its variables. It can be positive in some and negative unit in others, but it has to be unit in each and every one of the variables. to give you an example here, if you look at the function shown here, and the cover specifically consisting of AB, A prime, C prime, and BC prime, we can see that in this case, if you look at the variable A appears both in positive form, complemented and uncomplemented forms, positive and negative forms. Therefore, the function f in this case is binate in A. It's not unate in A. Equivalently, you can look at, you can derive the same observation by looking at the vector notations of the different cubes. So these are precisely the vector notations of the three cubes written above. And if you look at the column A, you will see that both a 1 and a 0 appear. Therefore, the function is binate in the variable A. Similarly, if you look at column B, you see that only a 0 does not appear. So you have only 1s and dashes, which means that f is positive unate in B. And similarly, looking at the third column here, you can see of that matrix, you can see that f is negative unate in variable C. Okay. So, or to be precise, this cover is binate in A, and this cover is positive unate in B, and the cover is negative unate in C. So, we've talked about unate functions and unate covers. Aren't they really one and the same? It turns out that not exactly. There is a one-way relationship between unate functions and unate covers. In other words, if a unate cover exists for a function, then the function also is guaranteed to be unate. Okay? So, I'll repeat. Covers are ways of representing functions. If you have a cover for a function that is unate, then you're guaranteed that the function itself is unate. But the other way around is not true. In other words, you may have a unate function, but the cover may be non-unate. So if you have a non-unate cover, it doesn't mean that the function itself, or a binate cover, it doesn't mean the function is binate. Okay, it might be just because the cover is not unique. A unate function will have at least one unate cover, but it may have additional covers that are not unate. To give you a simple example, if you think of the cover, so can we think of a non-unate cover for the same function? Remember, a non-unate cover or binate cover has to have at least one of the variables. So, first of all, is this cover unate? Do we agree that this cover is unate in all its variables? It is positive unate in each of the variables because you do not have complement of any variable appearing. Can we, for the same function, can we come up with a cover that is binate in at least one of the variables?
Multiply any terms with some variable plus the complement.
Right. So you can take AC and express AC as ABC plus AB prime C. And this does not change the function. It doesn't change. In fact, all that you're doing is you're recognizing that B or B prime is logic 1. So you can rewrite AC as ABC or AB prime C. And you add the other terms as is, and that gives you a cover that is now binate in variable B. So, looking at a cover, if the cover is not unate, you cannot immediately conclude anything over the function. However, if the cover happens to be unate, then you can conclude something over the function. The function also is unate. Okay? So there is a one-way relationship between unate covers and unate functions. Yes.
You mean AC plus
BC plus AB? I'm sorry. I meant AB. Thank you. Yes, that's what I meant. Although, I mean, you know, it was true even for AC, but that's what I meant. Yes, thank you. Okay, so we've looked at the concept of unate covers and unate functions. Now, why are these so interesting, right? I've introduced these, but we have a purpose, larger purpose in mind. Why are unate functions so interesting? It turns out that unate functions are special cases of the larger family of Boolean functions for which many operations are drastically simplified. Let me give you some examples of some results, properties of unate functions that make analyzing them and performing various operations on them easy. First, the complement of a unate function is also unate. The cofactors of a unate function with respect to any variable are also unate. So you cofactor unate function. Remember, cofactoring is just setting the variable to 0 or 1. Cofactors are also unate if you start off with something unate. A unate cover is a tautology if and only if it contains a row of all dashes. Okay, so there is only one way, and when I say row of all dashes, now think of the vector notations of the cubes. That's the context in which, or sense in which we mean row of all dashes. Tautology checking is an important problem in design automation. Okay, so if you look at the function and different, we talked about different representations of functions, and different representations have different complexities of different performing different operations. It turns out that for unate functions or unate covers, tautology checking is trivial. You just need to look at the cover and see if there is any row or cube which contains no literals. Okay, so it's very easy to perform tautology checking for unate functions. We are talking of two-level minimization, right? So we are concerned about generating primes. If a function is unate, then any prime cover of the function is also a unate cover. Okay, so we said, remember, we said unate functions may have unate covers and non-unate covers, but if it's a prime cover and the function is unate, the cover also is going to be unate. Okay. This is a big one for two-level minimization, right? Every prime of a unate function is essential. Why is this a big deal? Remember, what did we say about essential primes? They uniquely cover one of the minterms of the function. No other prime is going to cover them. So they need to be part of your minimum two-level cover. So what is the corollary of this function, of this theorem? What does this really mean? For unate functions, generate all the primes and that is your minimum cover. There is no covering problem. Right? You just need to generate primes. Every prime of unate function is essential. So then the next theorem actually addresses how to generate primes. You're still left with the problem of generating primes. It turns out even generating primes is easy for a unate function. If a unate cover, any unate cover, is SCC minimal. Remember what was SCC minimal? SCC is single cube containment. Single cube containment means one of the cubes of the cover is fully contained in another cube of the cover. So you just need to look at pairs of cubes of the cover and make sure that you don't have any containment relationship. None of them is fully contained in any other of them, of the cubes. So if you ensure that a cover is minimal with respect to the single cube containment property, then that cover is automatically prime. So if you have a unate cover, it's very easy to make it a prime cover, to ensure it's a prime cover, that it's a prime cover. And then it's trivial from that point onwards to generate a minimum cover, because just all primes need to be included in the minimum cover. So the summary is that many operations are greatly simplified for unate functions, including some of the operations that are useful in two-level minimization. Tautology checking, for example, generation of primes, complementing. We'll look at all these cases, right? But the reason we are talking about unate functions is that unate functions are a special case, or form special case of the more general family of Boolean functions, for which many operations, including two-level minimization or steps involved in two-level minimization, are greatly simplified. You can do it very efficiently. Okay. Unfortunately, you know, not all functions are unate, right? So yes, I told you that, okay, if your function, if you happen to be lucky and you have a unate function or a unate cover, you can do a lot of these things very easily. But you're going to immediately come back and tell me, in real life, you know, it's not always, you're not always going to get lucky. There are a lot of functions that are going to be binate. So what do you do about them? Okay. Well, this insight is still useful, even for binate functions, right? The way we will use unate functions to simplify all of those operations we talked about for non-unate functions is by using recursive divide and conquer, right? Remember, even though your original function may not be binate, if you can figure out, may not be unate, if you figure out a method to do a divide and conquer, whatever operation you want to perform on this function, if you can apply it in a recursive manner on cofactors of the function. Remember Shannon's expansion. Take the function, recursively divide it into simpler functions. At any point in that recursive division, if you hit something that is unate, you stop there. Because then the operation is trivial. You don't need to continue doing the recursion. Right? So we will combine Shannon's expansion and the unate properties, the properties of unate functions, to come up with this generic paradigm known as unate recursive paradigm, which helps you address binate functions. In practice, of course, many functions are binate. You know, unate functions are relatively rare. So the concept is, once again, use Shannon's decomposition on the original function divide it into cofactors, and then stop when the leaves are unate. You don't need to go all the way down until you hit the leaves of the cofactoring tree where, you know, the functions are 0 or 1. You reach the constant 0 or 1. You stop at as soon as you hit a unate subfunction. And you use this efficient techniques to perform whatever operation you're performing on the unate function. And then you need to merge the results of leaves. So you, as you go down the tree, you keep looking for, start with your original function. In this case, you're cofactoring with respect to variable A, B, and C. And the moment you hit unate leaves, you or unate functions, you stop and you use the special case techniques that work efficiently. But then what you need also is a way of merging the results of whatever you did on the that you computed for the unit leaves and merging them as you go up the tree to get whatever it is you're looking for, the answer to the original problem on the original function, right? And the reason this works is because the operation on these unit leaves is computationally less complex and you can use very efficient heuristics. So let's give an example. So to summarize, the unate recursive paradigm essentially combines two key concepts that we've learned. One is the concept of Shannon's expansion. You can take a function and recursively divide into subfunctions by cofactoring. And the second is the concept of unateness, unate functions, and the fact that many operations of interest to us can be performed much more efficiently on unate functions. So you start off with function that is binate. Keep recursively applying Shannon's expansion until you see unate functions. The moment you see unate functions, stop, use the efficient special case techniques that you know that work for unate functions, and then you still need a way of merging those results as you go back up the tree to get the result on the original function itself. Let's look at an example of how we apply this. We saw that tautology checking was efficient for unate functions. So now, how can we extend that observation using the unate recursive paradigm to perform tautology checking for, excuse me, for arbitrary functions? So the input that you're given is a cover representing the function f. And the output that you are expected to provide is a yes or no, depending on whether f, the function f is a tautology or not, right? So, and we will make use of the following theorem to recursively divide the original problem into subproblems. Any function f is a tautology if and only if fx and fx prime are both tautologies. So x is any of the input variables of the function. F is a tautology if and only if both its cofactors with respect to any variable are a tautology, are tautologies. Okay. So we'll exploit that fact. That's what allows you to actually do the recursive divide and conquer approach to this problem and use the unit recursive paradigm. So this, the first theorem allows you to divide the problem into subproblems, but you still need the special cases. So in this case, we know the special case result for unit functions is that a unit cover is a tautology if and only if it contains a tautology cube. That is a row of all dashes. So this, both of these things taken together suggest a recursive approach that you can use a recursive approach for tautology checking. You start off with the question, is f equal to constant 1 or not? You're breaking it up into smaller, simpler problems, hopefully. Is fx equals 1? Is fx prime equals 1? Based on the answers to these, you compute the answer to the top level problem. If these functions, fx and fx prime, are unate, you stop and use the result that we have here. If these covers are unate, to be precise. If they are not unate, you continue recursively going until you hit unate functions. Okay? So, in general, what do we need to know to apply unate recursive paradigm to solve a problem? We need to know how to split the problem into smaller subproblems, right? And first of all, you need to know that it is okay to split. The first theorem tells you the way that it is okay to split this problem into subproblems, and you can combine, it also tells you that you can combine the answers to the subproblems to give you an answer to the original problem. Right? So in a sense, one, the first and third questions are sort of often related. Because, you know, the way you split also tells you, the fact that you can split also should suggest how you combine the results to the subproblem to give you the original answer to the original problem. And the other is, how do you decide when you stop splitting? In the unit recursive paradigm, this is always the same. This is basically when the function is unit. Okay? You stop when the function is unit. So you need to know that it's okay to split. How do you split? There's always a choice, for instance, of which variable you pick. You know, if a function has many input variables, which variable do you cofactor on? Right? That may have an impact on how deep you need to go in this recursive cofactoring tree before you hit unit subfunctions. Right? So you ideally you would like to be intelligent in that choice as well. So it's not just whether you can split, but how to split, and then how to decide when to stop splitting, and how do you merge the results as you go back up the tree. Any questions about the general concept? We will work out examples, but any questions about the general concept? Okay. So let's try to solve, to apply the unit recursive paradigm for tautology checking. And let's say we are given this example function, which consists of a bunch of cubes, A, B, A, C, A, B prime, C prime, and A prime. So we will start off with the original function, and it's often convenient to represent the cubes in the equivalent vector notation. So there is three variables here, A, B, and C. So these are your variables A, B, and C, and each of these rows in the matrix is going to be one of the cubes. So A, B is nothing but 1, 1 dash, because A and B appear in uncomplemented form, and C does not appear. Similarly, A, that's A, C. And you have A, B prime, C prime. And just A prime. So this is your original cover. Is this a unate cover? Because if it's a unate, first thing to check is if it's unate. Because if it's unate, you're done. You don't need to do anything else. Right? It's not unate. Clearly, it's binate in A because you have both ones and zeros. It's binate in B and it's binate in C. Okay, so this is an example where you cannot directly apply the special case result for unateness, for unate covers. So let's pick a variable here to cofactor with respect to. Usually, there is multiple considerations in picking the variable, but usually since you are trying to eliminate the binateness, it makes sense to pick a binate variable. You know, in this case, all the variables, the cover is binate in all variables, but in general, you may have a cover which is unate in some variables and binate in others. It doesn't help really to cofactor on the unate variables. Okay? You want to pick the binate variables because you want to eliminate binateness in a sense. Okay? And for the same reason, this is again just a heuristic, but it also helps often to pick variables which correspond to columns where you have roughly equal number of zeros and ones. Any intuition as to why that's the case? Why does it help to pick columns with roughly equal numbers, balanced columns with roughly equal? You may have a balanced tree, that's right. Right? Okay. So let's go on, apply URP to check whether this function is a tautology. So let's say we pick variable C. Okay? So you do this with respect to C prime and C. So what is the cofactor of this cover with respect to C prime? If you have AB, what happens when you cofactor AB with respect to C prime? The cube AB. So take each cube, set C equals 0 in that cube, and write the resulting cube here. So if your original cube is AB, it doesn't involve C, so setting C equals 0 has no effect on the cube, right? So that row propagates as is. So any row with a dash propagates as is. Okay? 1, 1, dash. A row with a 1 in the C column disappears, right? Because essentially if you have AC and set C equals 0, it becomes 0. So that cube disappears. So that cube is not present anymore in this cofactor. You have AB, C prime. So setting C equals 0, sorry, AB prime, C prime, setting C equals 0 will make it just AB prime, right? So in other words, whenever you have a 0 in the C column, you turn it into a dash, and the other entries remain the same, okay? Similarly, the last row remains the same. because it doesn't involve C in the first place.
Okay.
So this also actually suggests, interestingly, another the observation that if you have a dash, it propagates down both of the cofactors. Paths also suggests another heuristic for picking the splitting variable. We'll get to that in a second. But let's do the cofactor, positive cofactor with respect to C. You're going to have 1, 1 dash, 1 dash dash, and 0 dash dash. Okay. So observe what happened here. You started off with 4 rows, and each of the cofactors now has 3 rows. Why is that the case? Because 2 of these rows, the first and fourth rows, get copied, propagated along both paths of the tree. So in a sense, you've replicated them. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a bad thing, because ideally you want these to be as small as possible when you cofactor. So try to pick another heuristic when you're picking the splitting variable is to pick a column that is as close to fully specified. In other words, a column that has as few dash entries as possible. Because anything which has a dash entry is going to propagate on both sides.
Okay.
All right. So we've done the cofactoring with respect to C prime and C. Can we tell, are these unate covers? No. This cover is binate in both A and B. This cover F sub C is binate in A. So you cannot apply the special case to tell whether they're tautologies or not. So pick another variable to cofactor on. Now, what do we pick? We can pick, let's say we pick A in this case. Okay. So you cofactor with respect to A prime and A. So we've already cofactored on C prime. You're taking that result and further cofactoring it now. So if cofactoring on A prime, the first row disappears, the second row also disappears, right? So you're left with dash, dash, dash. Right? Cofactoring with respect to A will give you dash 1, dash, dash, 0, dash. Cofactoring now this cover with respect to A prime and A will give you right? So here we can clearly see that the answer is a yes. This is a tautology. Here the answer is yes, it is a tautology. And again, yes, it is a tautology. This one you don't know. Of course, by visual inspection, you know that it's a tautology because this is B or B prime, which is 1. But if you wanted, you could further cofactor with respect to B prime and B, in which case you will get the dash, dash, dash rows. If you want to just strictly implement this per the algorithm we're talking about, you'd perform one more step, and then you would come up with the answers. Again, yes, this is a tautology. Yes, this is a tautology. Now, what do we need to do to propagate these back up the tree? Remember, any function is a tautology if and only if both of its cofactors are tautologies. So in this case, both of these are tautologies, so you propagate it up and say, yes, this is a tautology. Now, both of these are tautologies, so propagate it up and say, yes, this is a tautology. The theorem holds. Both of these are tautologies, so F sub C is a tautology. And now, for the original function, F sub C prime and F sub C are tautologies. So, yes, this original function you started off with is actually a tautology. It's the constant 1 function just expressed in a different way. Any questions on how this works? Okay. So the general principle that we are trying to embody here is that if you know special cases of a problem, of a challenging problem that can be solved efficiently, try to start off with general problems and break them down into those special cases and take advantage of the special case techniques, efficient techniques that you can bring to bear in the special case. Okay, so now with that new insights, we've learned a new tool, right? A new technique, which is unate recursive paradigm. A lot of things are simplified for unate functions. So now can you can decompose binate functions or recursively through Shannon's decomposition until they become unate and use the special cases. Let's apply that principle to solve the problem we are trying to address. Remember, we are trying to address the size of the covering table. we are trying to address the fact that if you try to list out all onset minterms here, the table is likely to be very large because in particular this is the dimension, the number of rows is going to explode. So we are trying to construct a covering table that is compact, where the number of rows is as small as possible. So the question really is, can we construct a covering table that is compact? Can we reduce the size of the covering table by construction rather than computing a huge table and then trying to compress it? What are the techniques you can use to compress the covering table? We talked about the pruning techniques, remember? They reduce the size of the covering table, right? Essential primes, we talked about essential primes. We talked about dominance, we talked about equivalence, okay? Both in the column and row context. So we are looking at compressing the number of rows, the row dimension. So essentially row equivalence and row dominance. Can you take advantage of those to generate the table that is compact by construction rather than generating the original table and then trying to combine rows that are equivalent or dominant? We'll look at one example of how you do that. In practice, if you look at very large functions with 1,000 inputs, let's say, and actually construct the covering table if you could, right? You could not actually practically do it. So let's say you took something with, 30 inputs or 40 inputs and construct the covering table. What was observed is that in practice, the main form of redundancy in the covering table is that you have a huge number of identical rows. In other words, row equivalence is extremely common. Okay. So if you have 2 power 30 or 2 power 40 rows in the covering table, a huge fraction of them for practical functions, most practical functions, are very likely to be identical. Of course, you will say that we know that. We're going to be, if we have a covering table, we can find identical rows and then eliminate them, throw away all but one of them. The problem is constructing that starting point is what is going to kill you, right? That initial starting point before you apply row equivalence, that initial table is large. What do identical rows mean? These are minterms that are covered by exactly the same primes of the function, right? That's what the covering table entries mean. 0 means the minterm is not covered by the prime. 1 means it is covered by the prime. So if 2 rows have 1 entries in exactly the same positions, it means that these 2 minterms are covered by exactly the same primes. So the question is there any way to construct the covering table such that as you're constructing it, you only have 1 row for each of these equivalent sets of onset minterms? Right? Instead of having huge number of rows and then trying to reduce them, by construction, can you just put 1 there in the first place? If you do that, it turns out that drastically reduces the size of the covering table. Okay? Because of the fact that, you have a lot of redundancy, massive redundancy due to identical rows. So it turns out that you can use unit recursive paradigm to solve this problem. And the idea is to start off with each cube in a cover for F. Rather than thinking of F in terms of each of its minterms, start off with a cover. A compact cover. You start off with an initial representation for the function, right? How is the function specified to you for two-level minimization? Specifying it as a truth table doesn't make sense. That's just too large, right? The initial starting point. What makes more sense is, here's a cover, which is not minimal. Here's some arbitrary cover for the function. Now you go and find me the minimum cover. So if you're given any cover for F, starting with a cube in the cover for F, suppose conceptually this cube represents, remember, a cube is nothing but a collection of minterms that it represents. So suppose this is the cube in your original cover. Conceptually think of this as a set of minterms. If you could start off with each of these cubes in the cover, and rather than break it down, what do we do when we construct the covering table conventionally? We take each and every one of the minterms here, each individual minterm, and try to write a row in the covering table for that minterm. Instead of breaking this cube all the way down into individual minterms, what if you could just break it down into groups of minterms? Do not unnecessarily go all the way to the extreme, but divide this cube up into these groups of minterms where each of these minterms will have identical rows in the covering table. Right? I haven't told you how to do it, but I'm just saying, what if you could do this? Then, in this case, for instance, suppose the cube can be divided into seven groups of minterms, M1, capital M1 through capital M7. Each of these maybe has several minterms inside it. But you know that each of these groups of minterms, each of these subsets, will be identical rows in the covering table. Then, to represent all these minterms, you just need seven rows. You know the fact for each of these groups, you put down one row in the covering table, and you're done. Okay? So, the unit recursive paradigm, it turns out, gives you a way of actually doing this division. In other words, starting with a cube of the original cover, which maybe, let's say the cube represents a million minterms, million onset minterms, break it down until into these smaller groups, until each group of minterms has identical rows in the covering table. So you don't need to further break that down anymore. So starting from a million, maybe you break it down into 10 sets instead of going all the way down to each of the individual million minterms. That's the idea here. So let's look at how that can be done. How can you do that? We take advantage of the following result. A cover C covers a cube if and only if C sub C is a tautology. This is a trivial statement, right? If you think about it, it's not a big deal. Basically, what we're saying is, remember, a cube is nothing but a conjunction of literals. So, for example, a cube may be x, y, z prime. Take each of those literals, start with the original cover, which is conjunction of cubes, right? And set each of these literals to the appropriate values. If they appear in positive form in the cube, set them to 1. If they appear in complemented form in the cube, set them to 0. If you do that, essentially that is nothing but the cofactor of the original cover with respect to this cube. That should be a tautology. Right? To give you an example, let's pick our favorite example. Right? AB is a cube in the cover. What happens if you set, so this is your capital C, this is the cover. Your small c, let's call it C1, is AB. So what is C cofactor C1? In this case, it's trivial. AB is 1, or AC or BC equals 1. So this is, of course, trivial when the cube itself is directly present in the cover. But the cube may not directly be present in the cover. The cube may be present in, so the cover may actually be okay, if this is the cover and that's the cube, the cover still includes all the minterms corresponding to this cube, right? The cover doesn't directly have the cube, but it still includes all its minterms. So again, if you take C sub C1, you will get C prime or C or AC or BC, but if you recognize that this is 1, then you know that this is again 1, right? So by definition, if you have a cover capital C and a cube small c, the cover covers the cube if and only if the cofactor of capital C with respect to small c is going to be 1, a tautology. Why do we need this result? Now, instead of thinking of any cover, think of the set of all primes, right? The set of all primes of a function should include its entire onset. Correct? Do you agree with that? It has to include the onset because all possible primes includes the onset. Now, let C be any cube of the original function. So you start off with the cover of the function, your initial cover, which is a bunch of any cubes. Let's say you apply iterated consensus. We talked about iterated consensus in the previous lecture to generate the set of all primes. Write this down to me. Start off with the cover to Cn, and then you apply iterated consensus, and then you generate the set of all primes. You generate P1, Pm, right? Now, if you take any of these cubes in the original cover, C1 through Cn, is it fully contained in this cover? Yes, because this is all this all set of onset minterms, and any of these cubes are implicants of the function. So they should have some subset of the onset minterms. And this is all the onset minterms. So this clearly contains each and every one of those cubes. So if you look at this, the theorem, you know that if you take the set of all primes and take the cofactor of that set, of that cover, which consists of all primes, this is P, with respect to any of the cubes of the original function you started off with, you know that P sub C has got to be equal to 1. You know that. You know, there's no need to prove it. You already know it. However, in order to generate, break down C into smaller groups of minterms that are covered by each of the primes, even though you know that P sub C equals 1, you go ahead and do the tautology checking. We just talked about, given a cover, how do you do tautology checking on it using the unit recursive paradigm. Do that to prove that P sub C equals 1. You know that it's already 1, but you're interested in a byproduct of this tautology checking process. So you go ahead and actually prove that it is 1 using the tautology checking procedure. Okay. Why do you do that? It turns out that in doing so, you will actually uncover which combinations of primes, which primes are responsible for this tautology, for covering the minterms of C1. Okay. So you construct, as a byproduct of that tautology check, it turns out that you can construct the covering table. Let's look at an example that will hopefully make this clear. Okay. So you start off with P sub C. So P is, remember, the P is the cover of all primes of the function, consisting of all primes of the function. These are your original cubes of the function. So small c is one of those cubes, any one of those cubes. Take the cofactor of P, this entire thing, with respect to one of the cubes. We've seen how to do that, right? Because a cube is nothing but a bunch of literals. You can take the cofactor of the cover, each of these with respect to those literals, each of the literals in C, in any order. It doesn't matter. The order doesn't matter. So that is your starting function, the starting cover that you start off with, P sub C. Let's call that G. Let's call that function, resulting function, G. So you start off with G, you know that G is a tautology, but you try to prove that it is a tautology using the URP paradigm. Okay? So you take the cofactor of G with respect to X1 prime and X1, you get simpler functions, you keep doing that. In this case, unlike the original tautology checking procedure, where you stop when you get a single row of all dashes, remember in our original procedure, you stopped when, if you have a single row of all dashes, you know that that's a tautology. But in this case, you continue when you have all rows of all dashes. So in other words, you have a full matrix of dashes. You do not stop when you have a single row of dashes. You stop only when you have a full matrix of dashes. Okay? So, and there's a reason for that. But essentially what the byproduct of this process is going to be that each of the leaves of this tree, covering tree, which consists of a matrix of all dashes, will correspond to one row in the compressed covering table. And in order to figure out that row itself, you keep track. Remember that G consists of some primes, right? So originally, P, if you write P in the vector form, it's going to be a matrix consisting of M rows, right? Each of these, this will be P1, is going to be the first row, P2 is going to be the second row, and so on, right? So this is, take each of these primes and just translate them into the 0, 1, dash vector notation. When you cofactor with respect to any variable, some of these primes will be, go down one of the paths or the other, and some of the primes will go down both the paths. Remember, if you have a dash entry in the variable that you're cofactoring with respect to, that row will propagate down both the paths. If you have a zero entry, it will propagate down only down the zero path. If you have a one entry, it will propagate only down the positive cofactor path, right? So essentially, you have these numbering of the primes. You tag the primes 1 through M. I'm sorry, not N. 1 through M, right, to be consistent with M here. And for each of the rows in these cofactors, you can keep the tag of the row that generated it. Because essentially you take every row and either it propagates down or it does not, right? So you keep these tags, maintain the tags of all the primes that propagate down these paths, and those are precisely the tags I have here. What do those tags tell you? Those tags tell you the set of primes that cover, if you remember, the original cube is a bunch of minterms. What you're doing by taking the further cofactoring G with respect to additional variables is you're taking that set of minterms and breaking it down into a smaller, two smaller groups of minterms. One set where x1 is 0, other set where x1 is 1. Again, you're breaking that resulting group into smaller, even smaller groups where, and so this group corresponds to the case where x1 is 0 and x2 is 0. So each of these leaves corresponds to a smaller set of minterms, which is a subset of your original cube that you started off with, C. Right? Intuitively, what you're doing is you're taking P cofactored C, but you're taking that result and then further cofactoring in this case, let's say, with respect to x1, x2. So what is the set subset of minterms that is represented by this leaf? All the literals of C and x1 and x2. That is a smaller cube. That is the cube that now, you know, the subset of the original cube that is represented by this node of the tree. And what this matrix of all dashes is telling you is that all the minterms contained in that cube, corresponding to the original cube and x1 and x2, are all covered by primes 3, 5, and 6. So in other words, for all of these minterms, so this could have a large number of minterms, depending on how many variables you have not yet cofactored with. Remember, the original cube has a subset of variables of the function. And you've taken a few more variables and cofactored with respect to them, you still have several variables remaining. The more variables you have remaining, the better, because this represents a larger set of onset minterms. But that entire, this set of onset minterms, subset of onset minterms needs only one row in the covering table. So if you have 3, 5, 6, you make entry 3 a 1, 5 a 1, 6 a 1. Similarly, so each of these leaves of this tree, tautology checking tree, will correspond to a single row in the compressed covering table. And these tags of these leaves tell you which primes cover all the minterms represented by each of these leaves. And therefore, they allow you to derive the entries of the covering table. Yes, sir.
I'm a little confused by this tagging. What do they exactly represent?
So the tagging is just to identify the primes that are responsible, correspond to each of these rows. Remember, we are starting off with a cover that consists of all primes.
Right.
So if you think of that original cover, each of the rows in that cover corresponds to one of those primes. And once you take P sub C, still, potentially some of those rows are going to be, some of those primes are going to be eliminated because the cofactor becomes zero, then it won't be included anymore in P sub C. But whatever remains still corresponds to one of the original primes of the function. So if you take the representation of G as a matrix, its rows correspond to some of the primes of the function, original function. So you just keep, let's say you identify those primes, you give them unique numbers or labels. So we are just keeping track of the rows so that you can find out for each of these leaves or collection of onset minterms of the original function, which are the primes that cover them. Because what does a row of all dashes mean here? That prime 1 covers C and x1 prime and x2 prime. That's what it means. Similarly, prime 4 also covers all those minterms in represented by C, x1 prime, x2 prime. Similarly, prime 6 also covers all those minterms.
So what does this signify that prime, the tag of 6 is appearing thrice? So it's covering all these minterms, x2 prime?
Whenever the tag of 6 appears here, so this is one row in the covering table,
right.
The 6th entry will be a 1.
Okay.
So this, the tags directly correspond to the columns of your covering table.
Mm.
Right? Because they correspond to primes. So in this case, among the rows I've shown here, you know, the tag 6 appears thrice, which means you have these three entries to be ones. Okay, so to summarize, you start off with the set of all primes, cofactor it with respect to one of the cubes. You have, remember, your initial cover that you started off with for the function, that was your initial specification of the function as a bunch of cubes. Take one of those cubes, take the cofactor of P, which is the collection of primes, the cover consisting of all primes with respect to this cube, and further build the tautology checking, the URP tree for tautology checking to prove that it is indeed a tautology. You know that it's a tautology. It's a foregone conclusion, but you're looking for the byproduct of the process. And unlike the conventional tautology checking, do not stop when you have one row of all dashes. You stop when you have a full matrix of dashes. Right? Because that is when you know that all these primes corresponding to the rows of the matrix cover all those minterms. So you can, it is okay to have only one entry corresponding to all of them together. And you need to repeat this process for each of the cubes. Remember, you started off with one of the cubes and took P sub one of the cubes, P cofactor that runs the cubes. Now you need to do this for each and every one of the cubes. Because once you've gone through all the cubes, you know that you have accounted for all the onset minterms of the original function. Right? Okay. So you repeat this and what you have at the end, so each of these tautology checking processes will give you some rows of the covering table. Once you repeat it for all the cubes, you will have the entire compressed covering table. Okay, and that compressed covering table in practice is much, much more compact than the covering table you would originally construct by considering each and every one of those minterms. Any questions about that process? So it's a slightly more complex application of the unit recursive paradigm, but URP has other applications as well. And in this case, it turns out that, you know, one of the applications of the URP is to generate the compressed covering table.
This compressed covering table, how do you further process this table?
As before. There is no change. So once you have the compressed covering table, now you do covering on this. That's it. You need now select a minimum subset of primes that covers all the rows here. Each row here now is not one minterm. It may be a lot of minterms, but that's okay. It doesn't matter, right? You know that if you covered this, you've covered everything else. Yes,
Prasad. Once we get a set of these tables, mm-hmm. can we process them independently before combining them together?
What do you mean by set of the tables? I see. So you're saying P sub C1 is one table,
yeah,
so C2 is another table. If you do these separately, these are separate covering problems. You can do that.
Okay.
It would be suboptimal. But you could do it. It's still a valid cover. You want to cover each and every one of them, but by not considering the relationships between them, by not combining it into one single large table, you are not considering potentially some possibilities or some interdependencies between the subproblems. So you can do it, but it would in general be suboptimal. It's like saying, I have an original covering problem. I'm going to break it down into smaller covering problems and combine the solutions to a complete solution. That is valid, but yeah. That might be an interesting heuristic, you know, way of doing it. You have a covering table, you further break it down into smaller covering tables and solve smaller covering problems. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
So you have to list all the minterms you have encountered into one single table.
You have to list all the minterms into one table. What I've shown here is the minterms corresponding to one cube. So from the second cube, you'll get more minterms below this and so on. So you need to repeat it for every cube in the cover. So you'll have the complete covering table. And then solve the covering problem. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. If not, that pretty much brings us to the end of exact two-level minimization, right? So this is more or less the state of the art, you know, in two-level, exact two-level minimization. If you want the optimal result, branch and bound along with iterated consensus for generating the primes and using compressed covering table. This is the state of the art. The only advances or notable advances beyond that was to use implicit representations for functions, right? Where you use representations like BDDs to represent sets, which can efficiently represent sets. For example, to represent the set of minterms or to represent the set of cubes, set of primes, represent them implicitly as opposed to an explicit list. But for now, we will move our attention to heuristic two-level minimization. So let's quickly summarize. In exact two-level minimization, it's all about generating the primes, constructing the covering table, and then solving a covering problem. So in generation of primes, we talked about the tabular method and iterated consensus. Iterated consensus is what you typically use in practice because you start off with any cover as opposed to the minterm canonical form. You can start with any cover and keep repeatedly performing consensus and single cube containment checks, and eventually you're guaranteed that you'll end up with a set of all primes. Okay. If you're lucky, this set is not very large, and then you can go ahead and construct the compressed covering table, by using the unit recursive paradigm, as we talked about. And you're guaranteed that because of construction, all the row equivalences have already been eliminated when you construct the covering table. You may still have opportunities for dominance or essential primes. That's still possible. So you still go ahead, further apply those techniques, reduce the compressed covering table into a core, cyclic core, right, which cannot be further, on which the pruning techniques cannot be further applied. And then you have the choice of using either Petrick's method, MinSAT, or branch and bound, which is the most common in practice. And for branch and bound, again, you have a choice of different techniques for computing the bound. The most common one that is used in practice is the maximal independent set heuristic. And remember, in branch and bound, just because you've applied all the pruning techniques once in the beginning, you're not done, their utility has not been exhausted. Anytime you make a branching decision, you have a different covering table, so the pruning techniques might now again become applicable. So you keep applying them in every step of the branch and bound, as we saw. Okay, so if there's no further questions, we'll move on to heuristic two-level minimization. Why do we want to talk about heuristic minimization? Well, in spite of all of those smart tricks that we've talked about, for many functions in practice, exact minimization is still too expensive, right? So what might be a reasonable strategy for you as a designer to do? Well, maybe you say that I'm willing to give it so much time. So let's say I'll give 24 hours for my exact minimizer to run. If it doesn't finish in 24 hours, I'll time out and say this function is very tough. So now let me try heuristic minimization instead. So we need an approach that can deal with functions that cannot be minimized exactly in a reasonable amount of time. Okay. Approximate or heuristic techniques, they do not guarantee the optimal solution, but it doesn't mean that quality does not matter. You still want to strive for results that are as close to optimal as possible, right? The discussion we're going to have in class is going to focus on Espresso 2, which was a two-level minimizer and its associated set of algorithms that were developed at UC Berkeley. And these are some of the key people involved in the development of Espresso 2. The reason we picked this is because there was a period of about 10 or 15 years covering the 1970s and 1980s where there was a lot of rapid development in this area. And Espresso 2 was almost, you can think of as largely the culmination of all of those concepts. So in a sense, it represents the best of ideas that had been proposed over that entire decade or decade and a half. So start off with a quick historical perspective. As I mentioned, work in this area initially started in the 1970s at IBM, where they developed the mini logic minimizer. This is now in the context of heuristic minimization. I'm talking about heuristic two-level minimization. So, around that time frame, they realized that the functions, the circuits they were implementing in practice started to go beyond, from a size point of view and complexity point of view, beyond the scope of exact minimization. So they developed the mini heuristic minimizer at IBM. Almost a little later, there was at Tektronix Corporation, which later became DEC, there was another two-level minimizer called Presto, which was also developed. Espresso 1, which was a precursor to what the Espresso 2 algorithm that we're going to be talking about, started off as an effort to combine all of these algorithms or implement them in a unified software framework so that you could compare and contrast how they performed. And it's described in this following paper in 1982. But the insights that were gained into this problem during the implementation of Espresso 1 subsequently led to improved algorithms and the development of Espresso 2, which is described in the following book, which I believe should be there. We have a copy of this in our library. Most of this work, or almost entirely Espresso 2, was implemented by Rick Rudell for his MS thesis project at UC Berkeley, where in addition to the problem of minimizing functions with binary outputs, he also considered a class of functions with binary inputs but multi-valued outputs, or in general, multi-valued inputs and outputs. Okay, multi-valued logic hasn't really caught on. The circuit elements we use to implement integrated circuits are still binary. However, multi-valued minimization is still useful because you can take an output, a function with four outputs, and think of, rather than thinking of it as four individual outputs, when you want to jointly optimize all those outputs together, all those logic implementations of the four functions together, we can think of it as a multi-valued function, which can have values from 0 to all the way to 2 power 4 minus 1, or 15, right? So multi-valued minimization becomes useful in the context of multi-input, multi-output functions. Anyhow, talking about Espresso 2, the general philosophy when we talk about heuristic two-level minimization is to, if you think of the classes of optimality in terms of covers, right? If this outer ellipse represents the set of all covers of a function, right? We are interested in the set of minimum covers, right? So this is sort of the strongest notion of optimality, right? Where minimum, we said, is either in terms of minimum number of product terms or minimum number of literals, right? So there's a very, that's a very strong definition of optimality, of what, you know, the quality of your cover. But we can have these slightly weaker notions of optimality, which may also be useful. Because when you're giving up on exact optimality, it would be nice to say that I'm not in this class, but maybe I'm in this class, right? Which is, as we will see, the philosophy adopted in Espresso. So what are those weaker notions of optimality you can think of? If you cannot, minimum cover, generating minimum cover is NP-complete, but maybe generating, you know, one of these covers is not, right? So what are those weaker notions of optimality? Here's one way of thinking about it. A subset of the set of all covers is the set of prime covers, and Quine's theorem tells us that it's enough to look here. We don't need to worry about everything here, right? Because there exists at least one optimal cover that is prime. Okay, one minimum cover that is prime. A subset of prime covers are the so-called prime and irredundant covers, right? Remember, what is an irredundant cover? If you have a cover is a bunch of cubes, if you remove any cube, if the function does not change, that cube is redundant, it's useless, right? So an irredundant cover is a cover that has no redundant cubes. So if a cover, all the cubes of a cover are primes, and the cover has no useless cubes, no obviously useless cubes, you cannot throw out any of those cubes without changing the function, then it is both prime and irredundant. And clearly the minimum covers we are interested in, that exact two-level minimization returns, will be both minimum and prime and irredundant, right? Because why will they be prime? Because, you know, Quine's theorem tells you that they're going to be prime, and we're only searching for prime covers. And you can also trivially show that they are irredundant, because if they were redundant, if you had a redundant cube anywhere in here, you can remove that cube and you'll have a smaller cover. So that means the original cover was not minimum in the first place. By contradiction, you can easily show that minimum covers are also going to be prime and irredundant. In other words, this strongest set of solutions which follow the strongest notion of optimality is a strict subset, or is a subset of this set of solutions. So if you think of the notions of optimality, there are, you know, any cover is the weakest thing you can shoot for. Prime cover is something slightly better you can shoot for. Prime and irredundant cover is something even better, and the minimum prime cover is the best. Okay. So we know that it's difficult to guarantee for this minimum cover. So the philosophy taken in Espresso is we were going to shoot for something that is guaranteed to be in here. It's not guaranteed to be in here. But we will still do our best to make it as small as possible, as close in cost to these as, this as possible. Does it make sense? Okay. Another concept that is important to think about in order to understand the Espresso philosophy well is the notion of local and global optima, right? In general, imagine that, you know, you have the different solutions to an optimization problem listed out on the x-axis here, and the cost of the solution is on plotted on the y-axis. So imagine that, you know, in general, your search space may be multidimensional, but for ease of visualization, let's assume that you have only one variable that you're trying to pick. So you're trying to optimize the value of, minimize the value of a function. F is a function of one variable x. You know, this is a variable x. This is the value of the function that you're trying to minimize. You search through the different values of x. What you're really trying to get at is the minimum, global minimum of the function. However, if you're not guaranteed to be at the global minimum, it is good at least if you can guarantee that you will be at a local minimum. What is a local minimum? A local minimum is minimum with respect to some neighborhood of the set of independent variables that you're optimizing, right? So again, Espresso guarantees, in a sense, that it is close. The solution it returns may not be a global minimum, because this is in general NP-complete, you know, but it will be a local minimum. Okay, so these are two notions. The notion of optimality, even though you're giving up on optimality, you have a weaker notion of optimality that you still satisfy. And even though you're giving up on global minimum, you still return a solution that is locally minimal or locally optimal. Okay. So now let's look at the strategy that is used in Espresso, and then we'll discuss the details of the Espresso algorithm in the next lecture. The optimization strategy used in Espresso is known as iterative improvement. What does that mean? As the name suggests, the idea is to use certain optimization steps. You start off with an initial cover that you're trying to, which is an initial specification of the function. You would like to derive the minimum cover for the same function. You start with an initial cover, apply a successive sequence of improvements to this original cover that make it smaller and smaller. But each of these improvements that you make is a relatively quick and dirty optimization. In other words, it doesn't take a lot of time to do it. And you keep doing that. Okay. So to contrast with exact two-level minimization, if you think of exact two-level minimization, there are two steps involved. First is generate the cover of all primes, right, which is a set of all primes. This is a cover for the function. Generate a cover consisting of all primes, and then you select the minimum or optimal subset of this set, which is still a valid cover for the function. That is Quine-McCluskey, right? The two steps of Quine-McCluskey. Now, in heuristic minimization or approximate minimization, what you do is instead of generating a cover of all primes, you generate a cover consisting of some primes, may not be all, some subset of all primes. And then, instead of selecting the minimum subset of primes, instead you just select an irredundant subset of primes. So, remember the notion that each of these steps has been weakened now. Instead of generating all primes, you generate a cover consisting of primes. Some primes are, each of the elements of the cover is a prime, but you may not have all the primes in there. You know, it's some subset of the set of all primes. And it turns out that that's relatively easy to do. That's very, starting with any cover, it's, as we'll see, it's very easy to turn it into a prime cover. Not the set of all primes, but a prime cover. And then similarly, starting with a prime cover, it is relatively easy to turn it into an irredundant prime cover. Okay? But one, since these optimization steps are weaker, one pass of these steps may not be good enough. There may be still some scope for optimization. So what you do, and this goes back to the use of the term iterative in iterative improvement, is that you keep doing these repeatedly. One iteration of these two steps will lead to some improvement in the cover, in the cost of the cover. But if you keep iterating, hopefully, eventually, you'll get close to the optimal. You're not guaranteed, but hopefully you'll do reasonably well. Okay? That is the philosophy in Espresso. So this is probably a good point to stop. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. If not, we'll continue the discussions of the details of Espresso in the next lecture. Okay. Thank you.